If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 197. We're entitling the show Holiday Visits because we're going to revisit a topic we touched on, I think, 2 episodes ago. Actually, we talked about it last episode.
Okay.
And that's adaptive headlights, because Matt had a lot of questions about them. And so I did a little more in-depth research to kind of understand what is an adaptive headlight, because there's different types of adaptive headlights, because it's not like it's a single unified technology. It is new technologies that have been applied by various automakers in the headlight arena. And some of them, well, like in the United States, certain of those technologies weren't legal until just recently. And that was only because they were shoehorned into the infrastructure bill. Now, do I agree that they shouldn't have been illegal or should have been illegal? I don't think so. It's just another idiot, the NTSB just being a bureaucracy getting in the way of something that's good for everybody.
Well, and then there's that. It's not a law unless Congress passes it. It's a rule.
Yeah.
If the administration, including the NTSB, issues it.
True. But...
or a regulation, I should say.
Yeah, but that regulation made them illegal within the United States, so they couldn't be used. That certain type, and we'll get into that.
Illegal is a loaded word.
Well, yeah, it is a loaded word. But what it did is it meant that they could not be sold in the United States.
Which is different than illegal.
Than illegal, true. True. So... let's kind of go through. So adaptive headlights, the functionality of it, the goal of them is to provide drivers better visibility and more time to react to changing conditions ahead on the road at night. And so that's what all of these technologies, and it is like a suite of technologies, and some companies implement all of them and some companies implement some of them. And some of them were not prohibited. Some of them were prohibited. So what we talked about last time, which was the digital matrix LED headlights,
mm-hmm.
those were prohibited or were not allowed for sale in the United States. Also, a lot of these technologies are not retroactively, you're not able to retroactively add them to an older vehicle because they involve sensor suites and things like that that the vehicles won't have. And oddly enough, the idea of adaptive headlight technology, because it is a bunch of technologies, they've been around for quite a while, a lot longer than I looked at or I thought of when we were talking about the digital matrix LED headlights. So the most common form of adaptive headlight technology is automatic high beams. Which switch to low beams in the presence of oncoming traffic.
Which I hope actually works.
Well, and that's the thing. So basically, there's some weird things about it too. Unlike conventional high beams, which must be manually engaged, the automatic ones are always on high beam unless they encounter oncoming traffic. Or traffic that's in front of you. So it'll switch to low beams, you know, if there's a car going the same direction as you, but in front of you, so that you're not blinding them in their mirrors.
Well, and that's the issue.
Yeah. And so what happens is there's a sensor, like I said, most of these technologies are not, you cannot retrofit an older vehicle that does not have them, you know, unlike putting LED headlights in a vehicle.
Those are the ones that need to be outlawed.
6 of 1, half a dozen other. I don't totally agree. But let me go on. So there's a sensor that detects lights of nearby vehicles, whether it's tail lights of vehicles moving in the same direction or the headlights of vehicles in oncoming lanes that dims them. The sensor turns the high beams off to avoid dazzling, I love that word, dazzling those drivers. When there are no other vehicles around, the high beams switch back on to enhance visibility. Although vehicles with automatic high beams default to full brightness, they still let the driver manually control the low beams or the high beams. If, for example, they want to make sure they don't blind oncoming traffic for the instant between the car recognizing another vehicle and switching back to low beams. And that was actually, that's the regulation from the NTSB, is that with the adaptive LED digital matrix headlights, why they were not usable is because there is no manual control. And then there's what they call ADB or adaptive driving beams, and the LED digital matrix lights fall within ADB. So ADB headlights, they're so advanced that they were prohibited in the United States until November of 2021. That's when the infrastructure bill went into effect. Instead of using distinct bulbs, so right now if you have a conventional headlight, there's actually two filaments or two elements in there. One is a high beam and one is a low beam. These use an array or many, many individual LEDs. And so instead of using the brightness of each LED can be controlled. And so again, using sensors, they can detect where another vehicle is in your path, whether it's an oncoming driver, it's somebody in front of you, and they can either dim or turn off certain of those LEDs in the array. But because they can control that, and it's controlled with many, many more individual elements, you don't necessarily lose as much visibility because they'll just shut down or lower the intensity of those elements that would shine in a driver's face, whether it's in the rearview mirror or it's in oncoming traffic. And so you still get a lot more visible light to enhance driving. And they dynamically adjust to those through software to other people or to other vehicles' positions. And it says, what I think is interesting, it says, in this way, there's bright illumination around those vehicles, but less illumination directly on the vehicles around you, which is kind of an interesting concept. So the example they give is that ADB headlights, they illuminate what's ahead of you, but project shadows on other cars to minimize dazzling other drivers around you.
How does it do that?
Well, that's because they're dimming and turning off certain LED elements in the array.
Read that statement again.
So, ADB headlights illuminate what's ahead, but project shadow on other cars to minimize dazzling their drivers. So what they're really meaning is that they're turning or dimming the LED elements that would, you know, shine up into drivers' faces, whether that's through mirrors or through the windscreen or windshield.
That's relying an awful lot on software that I don't have much faith in.
Well, software and sensors. And we all know that, you know, what is the lifetime? Not that the technology is bad, but again, we're talking automakers. They're building things in bulk. They're building things that have a finite lifespan. And electrical systems, particularly as cars have become more and more and more computerized, have become much more complex. And this is not an area, this is an area where companies like Tesla have been good at, because they're not a car company. They make their product is a car at the end of the day, but they're a computer company, a technology company. Automakers like Ford and General Motors and Toyota, you know, the guys who make cars for a living, they're not tech companies. And I mean, I know there's this race to where these guys are trying to come from the bottom and become tech companies, and tech companies are building high-tech products that are filtering down into the automotive industry. But at the end of the day, the expertise is not there. Look at all the ways that the, you know, it used to be when computers first got added to cars, there was two main logic, we'll call them computers, although the first ones I argue were more microcontrollers than they were computers. But you had a powertrain control module, which controlled the mainly it controlled your automatic transmission, you know, and it provided sensors and things. And most of it was for diagnostic purposes. And then there was a body control module that was that the powertrain control module was first. Then they added the body control module, which essentially did a lot of the same stuff. It provided diagnostic information and all that for the rest of the car. That was, you know, really the engine, and the powertrain did all the diagnostic and logging information for the transmission and drivetrain. And so, you know, for years and years and years, that was the extent, and that's where, you know, the ODB little port inside your car came from, and you could read, oh, we got an error here. And it would tell you things so that it would make it easier for mechanics on these more complex vehicles to diagnose what was wrong. And then they started adding the entertainment control module, which is more of a real computer in my mind, in that it collects information, it sends information, you can interact with it. It connected cars to the internet. Well, it also let hackers connect to your cars over the internet. And so, you know, same thing with these lights. I don't know that, I agree with you in the sense that I don't believe that these car companies who are putting these in, that the technology is so reliable. I think it's neat being a technologist, and seeing that digital transformation in the auto industry where, you know, computers and software, you know, IT is part of not just, you know, digital transformation. The concept was that every part of your business, IT was no longer a department that did things that helped the, you know, all the little departments, but they were the integral part of every part of your business, you know? So all of a sudden an IT department doesn't make sense because it's integrated throughout everything your company does. Well, we're now seeing that in our personal lives too, including automobiles. And these companies who are making this technology, I do question how well they do it. I mean, I question how well Tesla does it. Look at some of the dumb shit that is going on with them, you know?
Well, I mean, I think that just furthers my point. To me, it's not about, is it cool? Yeah, it's cool. Is it going to cause me to have an accident because I just got blinded because some fool driving the other direction just had these ridiculous lights?
I don't think the lights we are...
And if it works, great.
Yeah. Well, the thing is I don't think the issue is that you're going to get any less blind. Well, the idea is that you're automating the issue, so you're taking it out of an individual driver's hands. Because, I mean, there are a lot of people who turn their high beams on and they never turn them off. And that's usually who blinds you. It's not the fact that they have LED lights. It's that the LED lights, the high beams, which provide wonderful, wonderful visibility, are always projecting into your face as opposed to keeping the low beams on. But it's kind of funny. Part of the problem, we could have had this technology 14 years ago being ubiquitous, which would probably solve a lot of these issues with like LED headlights. LED lights make sense in cars because they take less power. They last a lot longer. You know, they are more durable. And that, you know, there's no warm-up cycle within them, you know, depending on the weather and temperature.
Well, that's true of lighting, period. I mean, not just auto headlights, but lighting in general.
Yeah, exactly. But that's why they wanted to move to that technology. Particularly since LEDs are a DC, a direct current technology, and cars run on all cars in the world today, there's a couple exceptions, but the standard is pretty much 12 volt DC electric. So there's no conversion going back and forth. And although incandescent headlights don't need a conversion, they are made different so that they can use DC power as opposed to an incandescent light you plug into your home, which runs on 60 hertz alternating current.
Which is why I can't just take a light bulb and go put it in my car.
Exactly. And so it's, I think it's a neat technology. For the most part, the digital matrix LED headlights are not here in the U.S. It's going to be a couple of years before you see them become more common. I won't even say ubiquitous, because it's going to be the car industry, you know, since you can't retrofit vehicles, you're not going to see even modern cars that are bought in 2021 have these LED adaptive headlights. But there, the regulation in question is FMVSS 108 from the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard, mandating that cars sold in the U.S. must have a distinct low beam and high beam pattern. And ADB headlights dynamically adapt their pattern and don't meet that requirement. So it was actually the automakers who petitioned the NHTSA to modify FMVSS 108 to allow for ADB headlights. But a compromise hadn't been released until Congress got involved with it, and it got added as a rider to the infrastructure bill.
Which is typical of how the federal agencies work.
Yes. Or
don't work, as the case may be.
Exactly. Exactly. So, that being said, those ADB headlights, which we're going to start seeing in the United States, have been available in Europe and other parts of the world for since like 2004. You know, it started on the very high-end cars, but, you know, as the technology became more ubiquitous, it flowed down to other things. But there are other adaptive headlights that are available in the U.S. One of them that I think is interesting, because this technology is so old that Tucker, go watch the movie with Jeff Bridges, had this in his original Tucker Torpedo, and that is curve adaptive headlights. And so as a driver turns the steering wheel left or right, the headlights actually pivot in that direction to illuminate what's in the vehicle's path.
Is that available in some vehicles in the United States already? Yes. Yeah, I was going to say, because I'm pretty sure
because
that I've rented a vehicle that had that.
That doesn't affect the FMV 108.
Right.
Or FMVSS 108. And some curve adaptive headlights, which are really interesting too, also change the angle of the headlight bulb in relation to the vehicle's speed to project lights closer or farther away. So the faster you go, the farther away in front of you, the angle of the bulb changes, so that your low beams will actually illuminate farther ahead of you. I'll never know. I don't drive any vehicle new enough to have any kind of crap like this.
Dude, you need to rent.
Yeah, whatever. Another one is cornering lights. And those have been around and have been unavailable on vehicles for a while too. And so what they are, they're fixed in place lights. They automatically activate on the side where the steering wheel is turned. So it provides an additional light.
Yes.
To, again, to kind of...
Oh, see, now I don't know if it was
curve adaptive or
if it was those...
Yeah, the cornering lights.
I don't recall.
Yeah, because they either come on when you turn the steering wheel or when you activate a turn signal. And then when you turn back to center or deactivate your turn signal, those cornering lights turn off. And the idea is that it temporarily illuminates the area in the vehicle's direction of travel. And cornering lights have been used for decades. They've been around, you know, since beginning in the 80s. And they're on new model cars today. They were originally, my understanding is, again, like all those technologies, that was something you might find on a Cadillac or a Lincoln. And then as the technology became a little more mature, it started, and they wanted to, you know, increase the features on their vehicles as the car market became really competitive. It started filtering down to lower models. So almost all these technologies, except for cornering lights, which have been around a lot longer, have been around in some form since 2010. So they've been around for almost 12 years. Started out on high-end, like I said before, high-end luxury performance vehicles like Porsches and BMWs and Audis. And but they're becoming mainstream in cars like Ford and Toyota and Hyundai. They're either adding them as standard, like I think cornering lights are becoming standard on several car companies. And some of the, like the curve adaptive headlights, because all it is it requires a little more logic and another plug in your car's wiring system. But those can actually at the factory be, you know, be an option that they can install. And I know that Ford is offering that in a lot of their vehicles, which kind of makes sense since the only car that they're actually selling anymore is a Mustang. So you're talking about bigger vehicles that are much slower to stop.
Yes.
But I thought that was interesting from a technology standpoint, because that's almost something that if you're really not aware of it, you're never going to notice.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, even in the rental cars that I've driven that have had it, I couldn't even tell you which of those I had on the vehicle. And I, to be honest, I don't remember which vehicle had it. I remember thinking, wow, there's a little more light here when I actually turn. So, I mean, it's not like it's...
Yeah. Well, you know, and the other thing is so... Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. There's a little more light. Makes it nicer to drive, but it's not something you're like...
Oh, wow, that's really noticeable. Yeah.
It's the same thing is, so, you know, I've been enamored with the Ford Maverick, the new little pickup truck that they have, not only because of its features as a base model, but also its price as a base model. You know, it's the first hybrid vehicle, I think, that really kind of hits a more consumerish price point that isn't a subcompact.
Yeah.
And, but one of the options, and it's a $500 option, and you talk about the difference in, you know, it's no longer a $4,000 or $5,000 package, but the 360-degree sensor package. Which, you know, if you've rented cars, these are the things that I've noticed more often, which is on the newer cars that have the 360-degree sensor package, you know, as a car approaches you, even though your rearview mirror, you might be able to see it in the rearview mirror, as it approaches you, a light comes on and you might get a buzzer or ding in your car to say, hey, don't switch lanes at this time, even if you hadn't planned on it, because something's coming past you.
Now, there's versions of that that are more annoying than others.
Yeah. Well, and there's also, it's the same sensor package, but the options of what can be done with them, too.
Yeah.
So, I'm trying to think, was it Mazda? I think Mazda had it with 360. If you had the Premier interior package, it actually gives you a HUD, like in a fighter jet.
Really?
And it gives you a virtual view, also with using cameras as part of that package. It gives you a virtual view of your vehicle sitting in the middle of the lanes and tells you if you're drifting from lane to lane, or you're too close to the right-hand side of the road, or too close to the center of the road, or the center line of the road, you know. It is pretty cool what it does. My question is this, because I tend to buy vehicles. I always, like, because I live on a farm, and we use pickup trucks all the time. My daily driver is a pickup truck. And then we have farm trucks, you know, which are the bigger F-250s, F-350s, F-450s. But when I go buy those trucks, I buy them with manual windows, manual locks, manual seats. Why? Because all that crap, after you have a truck for about 10 years, wears out. And some of it can be replaced, like the window motors and stuff, but it is such a pain to deal with. Just crank that window up and down, it'll last for 30 years, you know? And so my question is in these vehicles that have all these cool things, what happens when you're 12, 15 years? Because I drive a vehicle until the wheels fall off. So what happens when you're 12, 15 years down the road and one of those sensors has a cracked lens and so it doesn't work right anymore, or it just completely shorted out after a while or burnout or whatever? You know, what does that do to the usability of the vehicle? Because we talk about sustainability and we talk about reuse, but you know, a vehicle is the thing, at least the way we deal with vehicles. They may burn gasoline, which produces carbon monoxide. But for the most part, a car will last if it's taken care of. And I'm not even saying it's taken care of really well. It should last 20 years. And more than likely, if it's taken care of pretty well, it'll last much longer than that. But not with all these sensors and stuff in them. I mean, we call them classic cars, but, you know, cars from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s that have almost no electronic components are going to run happily for the next 70 or 80 years, if not longer. And but, you know, like F-Series pickup trucks from Ford, they're designed, I mean, they are fairly well designed because, you know, the 250s, 350s, 450s, you know, the bigger the truck, they're designed for fleet work, you know. So, you know, working in either farming or industrial applications or construction applications. And so their systems are fairly well ruggedized. And so those vehicles should, you know, yeah, you're going to have some maintenance issues over time, but they should be fixable in such a way that they can be used. But, I look at some of all these new things. Plus, same thing, you know, a car is not a laptop. You know, even if you're one of these people who switches that, you know, your desktop computer or laptop 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 until it doesn't work anymore, cars are not like that. People don't, you know, yeah, there are people who buy a new car every year, but that's because that car, the car that they have, will go into the used car market, and the next person who buys it may keep that car forever.
Well, like my aunt and uncle, when they were both working, they're both retired now, so they no longer do it this way, but when they were both working, would get a new car every other year.
Yeah.
And in fact, they would rotate
who got the new car,
who's new year.
Yeah.
You know, and so that did make it easier for you know, family members who need a used vehicle or whatever. But again, that's I don't think that's gonna a trend.
I've never thought that's always been the exception rule. My stepfather is one of those people who my mom says that when the vehicle he's driving gets dirty, he goes and trades it in instead of cleaning it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, about every year, maybe if he stretches it 18 months, he'll go and trade in the vehicle he has. And it is a game. He usually he has high-end vehicles, and so the trade-in value on them remains high, and so he can get another high-end vehicle. And, you know, he might pay $3,000 or $4,000 a year plus registration to get a new vehicle. You know, and for him, that's his thing. And I like to make fun of him for it, but, you know, particularly since some of the vehicles he gets rid of are vehicles that I would be like, I'll drive that for the next 20 years. Yeah. But I think that's more an exception than it is the norm. You know, I bet you not more than 5 to 10%, and I think 10% is really being liberal with this, of people who buy vehicles buy a new vehicle every other year. I have a feeling that it's not much more many people who buy a new vehicle every 10 years is another 10%. I mean, in my lifetime, my wife and I have bought 2 brand new vehicles. 2. And I might buy a third if I can, you know, if I can get a hold of a Ford Maverick. Which will be the first new pickup truck I've ever owned, and I've driven pickup trucks forever. And and that's because pickup trucks, not only the used ones retain their value, but 2, new trucks are just out of hand. F-250, Ford F-250, I've also looked at the Chevy 2500, so those are 3/4-ton trucks. The F-250... with, you know, just your bare essentials, starts out at like $50,000. I'm like, I don't want to, you know, put a second mortgage on my farm for $50,000.
Well, and that's just it. You know, we talk about the American dream and progressing as a society. we've gotten to a point where there are elements of the American dream that are just not beyond, that are just beyond the reach
of most Americans.
Most Americans.
Yeah.
A vehicle is one of those things.
Yeah.
You know, and
well, and you know, this is a difference between the United States and Europe. Europe, but you're also talking about whole countries are smaller than individual states in the United States. But, you know, most of the population is condensed around cities. And even if you're out in the country, it's not hard to get public transportation. Great Britain is a good example. Their bus system runs the entire, you know, north to south, east to west of their country, no matter where you are. Their train system is pretty much the same way. So getting on a train and going from, you know, the New Forest and in southern England to London is super easy. Same thing with, you know, a bus. And they have what they call them shell cards. And that's their bus and train pass, like you buy. And they're very affordable because so many people are riding the buses and trains. But here in the United States, you know, to go from a major city to a major city requires almost like, I can't quite fathom how this works, but you know, it requires getting on like a Greyhound bus, which is more like buying an airline ticket. You know, you can actually get Southwest airline tickets cheaper than you can get Greyhound bus tickets in many cases.
Oh yeah.
You know, and then getting on Amtrak to go anywhere is always more expensive than airfare, but there's no, you know, even like if you take Southwest Ohio, where you have the Dayton-Cincinnati corridor, which really isn't all that long. It's, what is it, from Dayton to Cincinnati is what, 50 miles, 55 miles?
It might be miles? Might be 60 at its max.
Yeah, you know, depending on where you are. If you're north, on the north side of Dayton, but there's no commuter rail to go just from Dayton to Cincinnati or Dayton to Columbus, which again is another maybe 60 miles east.
But again, that goes back to they keep talking about having federal and state funding for
light rail. I know
light rail from the three C's, and that's just on not
the Brent Spence Bridge.
Well, and that's my point.
You know, and
if this were a priority for anybody, it would have been done by now. But the truth is, even if they had built this infrastructure, it wouldn't get used enough to justify
building the infrastructure. No, I agree with you. The you know, the idea of light rail, it would take a cultural change. The United States, you know, as much as is they call it car culture, but I don't really call it car culture because it's not about car culture. It's about being independent.
Yes, I was just going to say, there's nothing more fundamentally American than the idea of rugged individualism.
Yep.
It's sewn into our DNA.
And the car culture is a reaction to that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, using light rail and public rail, you know, people, again, it's part of that American dream and that rugged individualism. And so everybody wants, it's not that everybody needs to own a car. Well, if you want to work, you almost have to have a car in the United States unless you're going to work locally. I mean, we do have public transportation in a more local area, but we don't. You can't work like 30 miles away and commute by train. There are areas in the United States where you can do that, like the whole East Coast, because Amtrak rents enough track that they can do from Richmond, Virginia to, you know, New York City, and that pathway. But that's not the norm across the rest of the United States. And that being said, as much as that train system is used in the United States, Amtrak has never made a profit since the government took it over. They've always been in the red. So that kind of tells you that even though it is being used, and I will admit, it is nice getting on a train, particularly the Amtrak that goes up the East Coast, and, you know, maybe riding 45 minutes to an hour to get to your place of work, because you can work on the way. You know, it's not like an airline. They have free Wi-Fi, and but you know, all of those things, that's adding to that cost of operation.
Well, and then there's that.
Yeah.
You know, if you are in a position where you could work on a train, that could then be factored into your daily routine.
Correct.
But most jobs in this country and across the world are like 9 to 5. You have to be there to work,
there. Yeah, exactly.
You know, so an hour on the train.
Well, yeah.
Zoom culture aside. You're not going to hop on a train for an hour, go to work, work 8 hours a day, hop the same train back an hour. You're just not going to do it. Europe gets away with that because,
well, again,
all of Europe is like an hour travel. I mean, that or less.
Well, I mean,
you don't have that here.
Correct. We might have that within a state where the major cities are interconnected, or you might be close enough, like Dayton and Indianapolis. It would be easy to work in Indianapolis if we had a train system. The other problem is because the farther west you get, the farther apart the large cities and places where exactly. you would work are, you would need high-speed rail. And the United States has never wanted to...
Which, that I've never understood.
I have never understood that either. Well,
as much business as occurs between Los Angeles and New York City, there isn't a high-speed rail that has a hub in Chicago defies all logic to me.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. You know, I think it is... The way the government... Well, it's because passenger rail in the United States is actually a government entity. It is not done by any of the rail carriers. Because basically what happened is...
There's no money in it.
Well, exactly. As airlines took over long-distance
passenger
travel, all the train companies said, hey, we're going to get rid of this because we're not making any money. But, you know, cargo is our thing. I mean, the auto industry depends on the train system because that's how they move vehicles, across the country. It's kind of out of hand. So I think that's a good place to stop.
Sure.
So tell us what you think. Send us some feedback to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. Please have a very Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
Listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.